Hello, everybody. For those I have the pleasure of meeting, my name is Michael Moe. On behalf of our partners, I wanted to welcome you to our 10th session in our virtual summit series. We're delighted that you joined us today. If you listen to the music to the beginning, we wanted to put the right mood because we're really back in the 60s and 70s, I guess. So I hope everybody's burning incense and has their fluorescent lights out. But anyway, I'm pinch hitting for Deborah introducing our first panel this morning. We had some logistical issues back in Chicago, but it's really my pleasure to introduce the moderator for our first panel, Zoe Bard. Zoe doesn't need any introduction. Everybody is well aware of her very distinguished career for the last 20 years plus as the CEO and chairman of the Marco Foundation. Before that, as a prominent lawyer and business person, many, many different accolades and awards, including Business Week, naming her one of the top 50 business women in the world. I'm gonna let her introduce the panel on our essential service, driving a national digital skills agenda to ensure access and equality in the AD workforce. After the panel, I have the privilege to interview Chris Hohenserich, the founder partner at Sterling Capital. So with that, I'm going to let Zoe introduce our panel. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure to be with you today, and I'm delighted that you're joining us to focus on the essential role of digital skills in America. Contrary to that cheerful music, these really are tough times. And I think that the high interest level in this panel reflects an awareness of how difficult these times are for so many people. At Marco, we've been working since 2013 to drive a skills-based labor market and to prepare people without a college degree for good digital economy jobs. I think the COVID crisis, we're all quite aware, is marking the historic transformation from the industrial to the digital economy. We've been moving in that direction, but I think we will look back and recognize that this was the moment at which we made that historic transformation. That means that digital skills are more important than ever before. We put out a report last year with our Rework America Business Network, which is a broad collaboration of large companies, that illustrated the importance of digital skills to even non-technical jobs, something we call the digital blind spot. In the months since we've released our report, remote work and automation has accelerated that need for digital skills and is exacerbating inequality because the people who lack the requisite skills tend to be very significantly people of color and low-income people. In our research to understand trends in digitization in the Digital Blind Spot Report, we looked at over 700 different occupations, and we found that while the popular narratives focused on the most digitized jobs, the software engineers, the data scientists, and the jobs that appear to be at risk for automation, that what was missed, the blind spot, was that nearly every job is experiencing increased digitization. Before the pandemic, more than 8 in 10 middle skill jobs required basic technology skills. 84% of small businesses were using at least one digital platform. And between 2008 and 2018, the largest increases in digitization were in occupations that previously didn't rely on technology. So just to give you a couple of examples, and I'm sure you'll have your own, but nurses using mobile devices to input patient data. We at Marco did a lot of work on driving the use of electronic medical records in the pre-2009 period leading up to major movements in that arena. And that's really transformed how data is kept in hospitals and in doctor's offices. Research on drugs, just looking up online, it was unusual for people, a nurse or a medical provider, to look up online a drug and drug-drug interactions. But that's now typical and often required. Medical billings online. Take another very different example, car mechanics. You know, if you think about it, it used to be you take your car in to be repaired and the car mechanic would look at it, tinker with things, and visually understand what was wrong with it, what needed to be repaired. Today, you take it in and that car is plugged into a computer for diagnostics. Records, photographs of issues, supply chain management, all that's done electronically. So all these jobs are becoming digital skill jobs, and that acceleration is even greater. But millions of Americans don't understand how to get digital skills or the access they need to it. The OECD put out a report recently that found that 41% of Americans with less than a high school diploma lack the foundational skills to navigate the digital environment. And as I said before, these gaps often fall on racial lines. So as we look to confront systemic barriers facing communities of color, we need to ensure that we're providing tools, training, and support to include these communities in the recovery. We need to do better than we did when we came back in 2009, when we really failed to think through how to get people into better jobs, and a lot of workers fell into hourly work or gig economy jobs. What we need to do now is to really invent the adult education system for the digital economy. You know, 100 years ago, when we moved from the agricultural economy to the industrial economy, we invented the high school. We created a system of standardized learning that was relevant to the industrial age, whether it be industrialized farming or other industrial economy jobs. And we haven't done that in this moment. We haven't invented the adult education system that will take the almost 70% of Americans who don't have a four-year bachelor's degree and get them the rapid and affordable skills training that's needed. And just to underscore how important this is in this moment of crisis with COVID and the economic collapse that is associated with that, the May unemployment rate for workers with only a high school degree at 15.3% was more than double the rate of unemployment for workers with a bachelor's degree of 7.4%. So what we're talking about today is really acute. It's acute both in terms of the needs of individuals, and it's acute in terms of what it's going to take to bring back our economy, because a lot of these jobs were hard to fill. These jobs that are going to come back that require digital skills, they were hard to fill before with people who had the skills, and we're going to be inhibited in bringing back the economy if we can't get people these skills to fill them now. So with a lot of partners, including people who are on this phone, and I hope many of you will let me know that you'd like to partner with us, we're focusing on a number of different things. We're focusing on getting federal funding for individuals to get the training that they need and to scale effective training programs, particularly those delivered online, and the wraparound services that coaches and counselors that we know are important for people to complete these programs. We're focused on actions by employers. Secondly, moving employers to hiring from talent pools of people who got their skills through prior jobs or post-secondary training, but not a bachelor's degree. The bachelor's has increasingly been interposed as a requirement, sometimes as a surrogate for other skills, but not a very good one. We can do better than that. And we're also working with educators to get them better information on the skills needed and to help people bring programs online. So with this, we hope that we and the broad collaboration of people working in this space, which I hope includes many of you, will be able to drive toward a labor market that will enable the businesses that come back and the jobs that come back to have better skilled workforce and broad numbers of Americans able to get the skills and the training that they need. So as we move into this conversation, I hope we keep in mind that we should not be working to return to a pre-pandemic world. And instead, our goal should be to create a new adult learning system that enables all Americans to gain the digital skills needed to succeed in the labor market and rebuild the country around the recognition and honoring of these skills so that we bring everyone into the workforce with equal dignity. We have a fabulous panel, and I'm going to begin by turning to Chike. I've asked the panelists to introduce themselves so we can spend most of our time on substance. Chike and Digital Us just released a report highlighting the importance of digital skills in this economy and profiling innovative solutions that could help learners and workers obtain the skills they need. So Chike, tell us what Digital Us is and what did you find most exciting and important in your report?
Good morning or good afternoon, everyone. I just want to first thank ASU-GSV as well as the amazing co-panelists that I have. It's very hard to follow Zoe when you agree with everything that she says, so I will try. But to the question of what is Digital Us and where I get to serve as a senior advisor, it is a cross-sector coalition of very diverse and disparate actors from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Foundation to almost all the organizations that are on this panel with me today, to the National Urban League, to do a really simple thing. How do we do what Zoe said, which is invent a system akin to the high school system to get every American worker the digital skills and the digital resilience to get new skills that they need and deserve in this 21st century economy? That is what Digital Us is. That is our moonshot. I think it's important to ground the answer to your question, Zoe, in the moment that we're in. We face twin crises currently. One comes from the novel coronavirus that we have not seen before. And then one comes from the persistence of racial inequality that's been with us since the founding of the country. And what both these crises have shown us is that the health system and the police system are not the only ones that are broken. That the economic system, that system of economic mobility that we press the American dream on, is not living up to its potential currently, and to be frank, potentially never was. And so the work that we have to do when we think about the Digital Us report and the work that Digital Us does, what we came to was that no one organization, no one sector can tackle this problem alone of creating an economic system that democratizes access to technology and its skills so that everyone can make of themselves what they will. This is an effort that has to be done together. It goes to the old African proverb, if you want to go quickly, go alone. If you want to go far, go with others. So Digital Us, again, 25 organizations and growing, diverse from all sectors, from all walks of life, focused on this moonshot and problem. And this problem is large. And Zoe, you set it up really well. Every job is now a technology job. There is no, it's kind of like saying, if you want to be a big company, you are an international company. Every company is an international company if they want to be one of note, same way that every job is a technology job today. So that's everything from all of us, I'm sure, have learned to use Zoom in the last 3 months to varying levels of effectiveness, whether that is a new sales platform, whether you work in retail and you're now using a iPad or iPhone to do stocking, whether it's again, you have to go online and figure out where you can get a coronavirus test done. Whether it's you're learning how to do online bill payment, every job is a technology job. And almost every activity now in our society is a technology activity. And like you said, Zoe, the people who don't have the resilience and the skills to take advantage of those things are disproportionately poor, disproportionately people of color. And it feeds into these persistent inequalities that we've dealt with for so long. And so when you look at the data of this, again, depending on the data that you look at, the majority of the American workforce doesn't have these skills. Two of three workers who are uncomfortable using a computer have to use a computer every day. When you look at the 32 million workers who don't have basic digital literacy and again, can't use a computer, only 10% of them have access to the training and the skills to get those skills. So again, you have folks who've been on the wrong side of inequalities for a long time, put it in an even worse spot because of our increasing reliance on technology. So we've got to step in as a coalition, as a society, to help get them those skills and resilience. And when we say resilience, we mean not just giving you the skills for today, but giving you the ability and the confidence to get the skills that you'll need tomorrow from a technology point of view. One of the practices that we're seeing is it really reflects less on the people who need the skills, but more on the rest of us, which is how do we embed the attainment of these skills and resilience and all the other factors in society. In the ideal, this will be called digital navigation function, would be part of everything. So when someone goes to get an unemployment benefit, we'd also ask them, do you want or need digital skills training? And they would walk out with that ability. If someone were to lose their health insurance because they lost their job and they went to go sign up for Medicaid, we would also make sure that we wove it into that process is a way to get those skills. And so thinking in some ways like my user experience colleagues do in Silicon Valley, but how do we design these services to make sense for the people that we're trying to help versus making them come to us is a really critical practice. And many of the folks who are on this call have dealt with this in a day-to-day basis. Let me say the last thing, and Zoe, I think you hit it really well from a high level on the stakes of this. What I like to say is I like to make this just very personal. For those of you who know me, my family, we are from a very far and out of the way village in Nigeria that most Nigerians themselves will never go to and never visit. None of my grandparents went past middle school. My parents had Peace Corps volunteers in their classrooms. And when they were in their late teens, they literally got a golden ticket to come here to the United States of America and to become part of the American economy and get American education. And that's why I'm here right now talking to all of you. We were able to get it right with my family. But when we think going forward about how we get it right for more families, digital skills, digital resilience have to be part of that. And I would argue that they're going to be the pillar of the 21st century American dream. And so that's what Digital Us is all about. How do we bring the right people together to get this dream to as many people as possible in as many places as possible? And those are the stakes. And so it's why we say it's not academic. It's a moonshot that is urgent, but also will take all of us. So Zoe, I want to throw it back to you. And for those who want to learn more, you can go to joindigitalus.org and you'll learn more about how you can take part.
Sorry, I thought the people managing the call were going to manage the mute. But anyway, thank you very much for what you're doing. It's extraordinary and it's inspiring work and really important. I want to turn next to a panelist who's at a company that's doing a lot of work in this arena and is a great partner to a lot of people. Andy, you want to talk about Walmart and how employers can be good partners as we work to build a system of adult learning that will enable people to get to meaningful employment outcomes and higher wages?
Yeah, absolutely. So I appreciate the opportunity. My name is Andy Trainer. I'm the Chief Learning Officer for the Walmart US business. I think we've been focused on digital skills, digital literacy for quite some time. We built out a training network probably 4 or 5 years ago across the United States with 200 locations that trained our associates on the skills they needed to do their job. And we immediately went to a very digital experience. So there was no manuals, there was no PowerPoints, everything was on an iPad. They got all their content virtually through a cloud system where they could take notes. So immediately went to digital. What we found out day one was we had to spend probably 2 hours every class teaching people how to use an iPad, which was not something we expected. So we quickly understood the need for digital literacy in the workplace, especially as you look further out to understand more and more automation will happen with the tasks, the menial tasks. And with that automation comes digital tools to do that automation. And so we need to prepare our associates for that. So when you start to think about how do you do that with adult learners and how do you prepare them for those skills, our initial view was let's make sure the skills we focus on digitally apply to all areas of business, not just Walmart. Because regardless, the way we feel is regardless of where they end up, we'd like them to stay with Walmart, but the reality is some won't. We still want them to be ready for the workplace regardless of where they go. So we really focused on digital skills, empathy, and customer service. And really, they're all tied together because more and more the customers will be using digital tools to shop or to search, and we'll be using digital tools to provide the products that they want and need. And so giving them those skills is really important. I think it's also important to not just focus on the current needs for skills, but the future. Digital tools and technology are changing faster and faster than they ever have before, even before COVID. But with COVID now, clearly the skills are and technologies are developing faster. And so making associates and people comfortable with being uncomfortable with new technology is something that they're going to have to learn how to do, because the technologies are changing so fast and there's new applications and new enhancements. As soon as you get used to one device or one technology, there's a new one that replaces it. Just look at the iPhones or whatever technology you want to pick. So being comfortable and brave, I guess is the word, to go and try new technologies that you've never used before, that's a big barrier for a lot of people. They're scared to go try something new because they're comfortable with what they've got. So in our training, we have started to integrate technologies that associates wouldn't interact with every day. It started with iPads. So 4 years ago, not everybody had an iPad. Even today, we're still teaching people how to use iPads. So as much as we want to believe there are a norm in our day-to-day life, for a lot of people, they're not. You think about digital learning in general, virtual, Zoom. We use a lot of different virtual trainings in WebEx, and whether it's FaceTime, Zoom, whatever technology, in our classroom, so they can learn how to do that. The cloud service, where they can access their content and their notes from any device, any phone, any computer, allows them to start to understand how to access information in different places in different ways. We use virtual reality quite a bit. Most associates don't experience or have the technology of virtual reality available to them every day. So we have started to really train and use virtual reality for training to get them comfortable with something they wouldn't use in their everyday life. In 3 to 4 years, just about everybody will know what VR is and use it all the time, but not today. Augmented reality, holograms. So one of the things we try to continue to do in the training is bring in technologies that aren't normally used for training and associates wouldn't see every day, to start to make them comfortable being uncomfortable with that technology that's out there. And I think lastly, it's really important to share what you develop and what you learn with the broader group. So one of the things we've done, Live Better You, is a education program we've rolled out where associates can get a college degree for $1 a day. It's online learning. So again, digital experiences are really important. And we've started to expand that recently into more, whether it's trade programs or digital programs, where they can get certifications and get qualified to do jobs right away, even before they get their 4-year degree. So again, because it's virtual, they learn digital skills, but it also prepares them for future jobs, regardless of whether it's Walmart or not. Obviously, we prefer them to stay with Walmart, but preparing them for future jobs inside and outside the company, and just be open to sharing those technologies with everybody, because the more the general society gets ready for these skills, the better we'll all be from a business perspective.
Thanks so much, Andy. It really underscores the important role of an employer as a trainer. You know, a couple decades ago when I worked at GE and Aetna, it was more the norm that employers, particularly large companies, trained their workforce. And we need to get back to that, because that's where people have the time to get training. They need to be supported while they train. And, you know, one of the things that's so interesting about Walmart is you have a workforce that has an unusually wide pyramid at the bottom. A lot of people at the lower end of that pyramid, more with the 150,000 you just hired, and few ways for them to move up. So the fact that you're training people to be able to move out also as a value they get in their job at Walmart is really important. And labor management efforts are being developed for this kind of training. Kaiser and the SEIU developed a really interesting program where they're training up healthcare workers. So I think that, and even small and medium-sized businesses are looking at this all the more because they can't find people with the specific skills to their business, like a small advanced manufacturing company, a company in plastics or 3D printing or something, because these are new roles. But if they can find people who had some basic digital skills, then they can move them into the specifics and do the training in-house. So you've really highlighted something that I think is enormously important to this digital skills agenda. I'm going to turn next to Angela, who maybe can comment on some of what we've said, but we really want to hear from you about how your work on the ground is fostering greater equity in the labor market, and also what the challenges are that you're facing, so that in part some of us on this panel and in the audience might be able to help you with them.
Excellent. Thank you, Zoe. Our NDIAs represents the folks that are on the ground teaching folks digital literacy skills, teaching their neighbors, right? Particularly those who are not lucky enough to have a Walmart kind of employer where this type of support is available in the workplace. So in the US, our situation is that we don't have a lot of top-down support. We don't have a lot of employers doing this. And what has resulted are grassroots solutions. So on the one side, that's awesome. Neighbors solving problems, right? But on the other side, it's a bit challenging because they don't have the resources to do it. They don't necessarily have the backgrounds, curriculum development, that type of, but what they do have is empathy. And that was mentioned earlier, and understanding where someone comes from. I love that Andy said, we need to become comfortable with being uncomfortable with technology. Absolutely agree. And that is really what the role is of the local digital inclusion programs. It's being that person that sits next to them, well, now 6 feet away, right? Or does it remotely, but is that reassurance for them? You can do this. It's okay that you're uncomfortable. We're gonna get through this together. This is definitely the kind of problem that technology is not going to solve. I know we all love our gadgets, right? I in particular love all my tech gadgets, but digital inclusion is not something we're gonna get at by building another app. It's not just that online piece, right? It is having someone like Andy say, you got this. I know you can do this online training, and I'm here if you have questions. So NDIA got started about 5 years ago because there wasn't an entity that was that national advocate or that voice that was helping pull those digital inclusion programs on the ground together. So our affiliates are all independently owned, operated, et cetera. They tend to be community-based organizations, housing authorities, and local governments and libraries. And so they are addressing digital equity and digital inclusion. I'll put in the chat the link for the definitions. One of the first things we did as an organization was create definitions because this stuff was still new enough. We were all kind of talking past each other. So digital equity, that's the goal. This is where we want to get. Individuals and communities have access to information communication technology. They know how to use it. They can do what they need. Digital inclusion is how we get there. These are the programs that would get us to digital equity. And they are programs that address the common barriers. There's the barrier to having internet in your home. Unfortunately, in the US, we know from census data, we have 18 million US households that do not have internet in their home. And that includes mobile phones. The census considers internet service anything above dial-up. Right, seems kind of silly, but that's how they go at it. That's a lot of folks. Of those 18 million, 14 million are urban. This is not just a rural infrastructure problem. This is an affordability problem. So we have the barrier of affordability and we have the barrier of digital literacy. Because why would you pay for a service that you don't really know how to use? So we need digital literacy training for workforce, for healthcare, for education, just for living really today. But we also need to make sure that that broadband is affordable. In the US, broadband is very much a commodity, is lightly regulated. There's nobody whose job it is to even track how much broadband costs in the US. I can tell you it's about 60 to 70, but can I tell you specifics? Nope, why not? Because nobody has the data on it. Why don't folks have the data? The ISPs prefer it that way. Okay, well, if that's the reality of life, then we're gonna have to come up with some other solutions on the ground to solve this issue of having internet in the home. And that's exactly what we've seen during this crisis. it's really been fascinating, right? Chike and I have been working on this stuff for years, and all of a sudden everyone's like, oh, there's a digital divide. We're like, yes, help us form solutions. And that's exactly what's happening. We're seeing it locally, where folks are figuring out how to purchase bulk purchase internet. Right, school districts are doing this, cities are doing this, bulk purchase it so that they can make sure that their students or their employees or their community members have access to the internet. And then they're making sure they have the right device. Unfortunately, too many of our folks rely upon a mobile phone as their only device. Just imagine that, right? Create a resume on your mobile phone. Work on a spreadsheet on your mobile phone. Like, do anything except the stuff that we like to do on our mobile phones. So those of us who have resources, we have a mobile phone and we have another device. Sometimes we have three or four devices because we really like our gadgets. But if you're forced to choose, you're going to choose the mobile phone over something else because you can take it with you. And it is your emergency. It is how you contact 911. So the things that we need to make sure that we're addressing are the home broadband, the devices, and the digital literacy. In regards to the digital literacy, it's important to note that in the Digital Us report, you'll see that it says half of Americans are uncomfortable with online training. That's a huge problem. Because really, what is the most efficient way to get folks some digital skills training? Put it online. So just as Andy was explaining with Walmart, and this is true with lots of folks, we have to be able to help them get to the point where they can take that training. And this is that idea of digital navigators. We need to have these folks everywhere. Because there has to be someone to turn to. And for many of you, you know who that person is, right? Some of you are that person other people turn to. Sometimes it is you turn to somebody else. And often it's that, okay, well, my mom comes to me for one thing, but I go to my husband for other things. And then my husband goes to his buddies for other things, right? So we all have people that we turn to, except when we don't. And where do those folks go? So the idea being that we have to address all of the barriers. And I'm super excited that this conversation is happening here.
Thank you very much, Angela. That is so important for all of us to keep in mind. And there's no point in our doing anything we're doing if it doesn't get delivered and become effective for people in communities. So we're grateful for all you're doing. I'm going to turn now to Brian. And Brian, I know you're representing Wiley, but I hope you'll share with people your longstanding perspective on digital learning, which predates Wiley, and talk with us about the education and workforce systems and where do you see the opportunities for digital learning?
Well, thanks, Zoe. It is a pleasure to be in this conversation. It's a conversation that sadly has been going on for 30 years or more. And in that time, we've made, one sense, enormous progress in that there are a bunch of people who have lots of digital skills and who are on the bandwagon and charting the future and doing so successfully. But there are massive numbers, and you cited the statistics earlier, massive numbers of people who simply are not on the train. And we need to get them on the train. So my longstanding viewpoint as a person in the industry of education for 30 years tells me it's going to be hard to make those changes, and we're going to have to work together. We're going to have to break some stuff. We're going to have to make people uncomfortable with the truth of where we are. And that discomfort will come in a lot of ways, but I think it's going to be essential. So Wiley's in a bit of a unique vantage point. We've been around for 213 years now. And throughout that period of time, Wiley has had consistency on a number of things, mostly our mission. And our mission for all those years has been dedicated to knowledge and the development of knowledge and learning, or the acquisition of knowledge and skills. And we have been through civil wars and prior pandemics and world wars, crises of all sorts. But what has been true is that knowledge and learning are essential to the future advancement of the world. And so that's what Wiley's dedicated to. What we know at this point in time today is that the supply and demand equation, the labor market equation itself, is broken. And it's been broken for a long time. Far too many unemployed people, far too many open jobs, far too many schools thinking they're doing a great job of preparing people for the world, and far too many corporations unable to find the labor that they need to succeed, despite the fact that there are many, many, more than enough willing and able people to fill those jobs. So crisis is a wonderful thing, and Chike, I think, outlined it earlier. This is not just a crisis of COVID. It's not just a crisis of social unrest, which we all find completely unacceptable, that far too many have suffered inequity and injustice for far, far too long. But these twin crises are on top of the prior crisis because the supply and demand equation was broken already. How could that be? How could we spend so much on education in this world? How can we spend so much trying to find labor and to upskill that labor and still have so many unemployed people and so many unfilled jobs? And the answer is it ends with collaboration, which is what this conversation is about, but it starts with a language. We don't yet speak a common language around the skills people need to succeed in the workforce of today, tomorrow, and the next day. That common language has been lacking for a long time. 30 years ago, we started to develop this common language when we started talking about things like national standards in education. And that initiative went forward in many ways, but got waylaid and failed in many ways. But one thing we never really talked about effectively is what are the common standards for digital literacy and digital success. So we're dedicated to this. And in fact, where we sit in education is that we help literally thousands of universities and thousands of corporations help to bridge the gap in the labor market equation. That's what we do. It's why we exist, whether it's the textbooks that you know us for, because a lot of people studied in one of our textbooks, which don't exist so much anymore. Now it's all complicated digital courseware, much more effective, much lower price. We're all happy about that. Or if we're working with corporations, to help them figure out how to find, to skill, and to upskill, onboard, make talent successful. We're on both sides of that labor market equation, and that, in fact, makes Wiley unique. So we have a very unique vantage point talking to university presidents about what they need and helping them to go online and helping corporations to do that. And what we know is that there still lacks a common lexicon, a common language for those two sides to talk to each other so that schools know what skills people need and corporations can articulate what their needs are. And if that happens, then the labor market equation can start to work. It's not enough, but it's a basis, which is why a few years ago, we joined with the Business Higher Ed Foundation to establish something called Project DARE, which we worked across 21 countries, including corporations, government agencies, institutions in those countries, to align on a set of data science and analytics standards called Project DARE. Very exciting, because finally we can start to have that conversation. It's why we joined Digital Us, because collaboration around these things is essential. We cannot do our job without that language and without collaboration. So all I would say, because I know we're short of time, is that we at Wiley are committed in our very essence to solving this problem. We're committed in solving it through the content we create, through the collaboration and support we provide to universities, through the platforms and systems that we provide to corporations. But most importantly, we're fully committed to working with all of you. And I don't mean all of you on the panel, I mean that as well, because we're all interested in the same stuff. I mean everybody on this call, because until we do, us selling a new unit of courseware or getting another university online, it's just not enough. We've got to have that common lexicon. That's what we have to commit ourselves to. And then we have to use that to create systems that make sure that everybody has the opportunity that too few of us have had in the past.
Thank you so much. We literally only have 5 minutes left, but I'm going to combine two of the questions from the audience for Andy and ask you, Walmart has a mature system of, and a lot of experience, years of experience training online, and you have been partnering with online training companies for a long time. What have you learned from that that would be useful for others, and in particular for startup companies? There are a number of people on this call who are trying to develop ed tech companies and would like to know, you know, what have you learned and how do they and their new companies without years of demonstrated data become part of these partnerships?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think the number one thing we've learned is people's attention span is growing shorter and shorter by the second. Modules that we would have created years ago online that could have been 10, 15, 20 minute video that you watch, people won't watch and remember them anymore. And so we've had to really adjust the whole aspect of how we deliver the message, how we maintain engagement, and then how they practice what they've taught after we taught them. So we have shortened the modules to 2 to 3 minutes at most. We like to create a lot of GIFs, short little micro learnings that they can do in the moment. We've created more an app where it's online, digital, searchable on a mobile device, so they can get the answers they need when they need them versus trying to cram all the information at one time and they may remember 10% of it and still have to go look it up when they need to do the task. So it's really more focused on how do you teach them what they have to know in the moment and then create a platform that they can search and view quick YouTube type, TikTok type training in the moment that takes 20 to 30 seconds. They understand how to do it and they can move on and serve the customers more frequently. So the days of sending someone to the back room to spend hours learning how to do their job are gone. We don't have the resources to do it. And quite frankly, students don't have the patience to do it anymore. And so it's really been adjusting lots of activities, lots of short, and make it easily accessible as they go.
Thank you. Would any of our panelists like to make a final two sentence comment?
The only thing that I'd add is I kind of would end where I began, which is this is work that's going to be done together. And again, the folks who are on this panel prove that. If you're looking to learn more about how to join Digital Us, you can go to joindigitalus.org. There's work for businesses, there's work for advocates. And also you can look at our Digital Us report, Building a Digital Resilient Workforce, and see things in there and best practices in there that you can replicate in your organization, no matter where you are. So we're going to go far if we can go together.
Thank you. I'm going to have to end us at this point, but thanks everyone to a terrific panel.
Well, that was great. Thank you so much. And I'm really looking forward to my opportunity to interview Chris Holinsarek, who's on the Zoom with me right now. It's not an overstatement to say that I can't think of anybody or over the last 30 years who's had a bigger footprint in the education space than Chris and his partners at Sterling. They were the owners operators of Sylvan Learning for many years, Laureate, which had 1 million students internationally, the Prometric, which was the leader in remote testing, Connections Academy, which was an early pioneer in the digital learning space, the homeschool space, and on and on and on. So it's really my privilege to have the opportunity to spend time with Chris this morning, get caught up where things are at and where he's going next. But before I do that, so Chris, let me ask you, Sterling is now 37 years old, which is pretty remarkable, particularly since you're not that old. So how did Sterling get going? How did you meet Doug Becker, your kind of partner in crime? And I know there was two other founders, Doug's brother, Eric and Steve, but how did this all get going and where did you originally meet Doug?
Yeah, so first, Michael, it's great to see you, and I'm glad everybody is sort of healthy and we can remain somehow engaged, even if we're all I think rooted in place in so many ways during this time. But to your point, it's been a long process, and we got started at a time when the world was in many respects a simpler place, and particularly education. I was in college and Doug was just starting, and we actually met each other during a summer job and basically wanted to start these were early days of technology. So at that point, this was 83, end of 83 when we sort of got started on things. The world was a small and simple place relative to where it is today. You'd get businesses going, and the tech companies were frankly junior league at that point. And you could, Bill Gates would show up at a sales meeting and talk to people, and it was a different world back then. But suffice to say, we started actually by thinking about at that point what we felt was potentially disruptive in the healthcare market, and started a company that was involved in early electronic claims processing using PCs, which sounds very quaint now, but at the time when everyone was doing things with mainframes and tapes and whatnot, the idea that you could integrate providers, store medical records, and do electronic claims processing was at that point in time was sort of a new concept. So we ended up starting a business back then, an early sort of tech business.
So talk about Sterling a little bit. I want to talk about a lot of things, and we're going to be limited on time, so I want to kind of shoot through a bunch of things. But it's interesting because Sterling's unusual that you guys are both, you're entrepreneurs, you start businesses, you operate business, but you're also investors. How does that experience as an entrepreneur and operator help you invest? And how does your experience as an investor give you a lens to businesses you may want to start and how you operate them?
I think the things that it clearly the chance to have been in the seat and saying, what does it take to start a business? The importance of understanding the reliance on, great talent, interesting markets, and trying to look around the corner to the next things that are happening. That sort of balance of experience and sort of the idea of compounding knowledge, more than necessarily just been in the operating seat, but have frankly the passage of time and the chance to see cycles and compound your knowledge in a space has been the things that's been most interesting for us. Because as a lot of this is a combination of pattern recognition, the ability to sort of see around the next corner about where things are going, interpret pace, because a lot of things in education is clearly one of those places where pacing is maybe one of the biggest challenges we have, because we can see where the future might be. The question is, when will it get there? And education has been, frankly, slow to evolve and change. And I think that maybe the balancing act for us is the one to sort of find this mix between experience in building teams, changing markets, the knowledge of the space and how that compounds. And those things together, I think, allow us to be better investors.
So talk about teams and partners, and you and Doug have been partners in the team with your other broader team for a long time. How do you complement each other? What is Doug really good at that sort of complements you? How do you complement him?
Over the years, I think what we found is that we've ended up going in complementary ways to be able to, I think the biggest area is in many respects, we don't co-run things. Things that I'm doing, often Doug may not be involved at an operating level and vice versa. But where we do get to sync up is really on strategic issues and really thinking through and having, often when you're in the role of having to make a decision on things, they're not necessarily good counterparties that you can rely on for honest, clear-eyed views of the situation. And because people who are working for you, you have to sort of motivate and bring people along, and customers are obviously in their role. So I would say, I think we played for each other sort of an, both an editorial function, a sounding board, an ability to have kind of clear-eyed commentary on what we think is going right and wrong, and obviously support at various times when we've needed the support.
So you guys have been operating outside the United States, you know, obviously inside the United States too, but outside the United States for 30 years. What has changed? What's most difficult when you're trying to establish businesses and run them outside the United States? And where do you see the opportunities today?
Yeah, so we're in incredibly unusual times right now. And so it's a little bit harder, obviously, when you start to think about where the future can be when the world has been so profoundly disrupted by COVID-19 and with sort of a level of anti-globalism. On the other hand, what we found over the years is that the patterns we see here, the issues that drive and have made the U.S. economy so successful, have really revolved around our system of capitalism, but also the whole ability for us to have built a system that encourages an upskilling of the entire population. There, obviously, just as your panelists were speaking, we have a long way to go. But we've also built a system which has the highest, conferring ability in higher education, and have in fact built a system here that has allowed us to skill up our economy in ways that others. And what we see around the world is in many respects that same thing happening. I would say 30 years ago, there wasn't the recognition when people thought about investing in other countries, you were thinking of infrastructure, whether it was power companies, roads, whatever it is, hard industry. And it's really over the last 15 or 20 years that there's been a recognition that really is a knowledge economy around the world, and the investment has to be in your people. So what we've seen is that trend has continued everywhere. And you're seeing in all sorts of growth economies around the world, growth in K-12, in higher education, in technology, the same things we see here, but with variations that are necessitated by different societies, cultures, governments. But no matter where you walk today, whether you go to Vietnam, which is just on fire right now, and which is sort of surprising because you have an emerging, essentially capitalistic society coming from roots, obviously, of communism and socialism that's embracing this idea, and it's bringing on board all the things we've seen here with a twist that would be Vietnamese. So we see the opportunity pretty much consistently around the world, in some places growing faster, some places slower, but it is a worldwide opportunity on the education landscape.
And you talked about anti-globalization and obviously some of the things going on specifically with China. Do you think the opportunity in China is going to be as big for American companies going forward, or do you think there's going to be some issues as it relates to being able to develop business there? And you talk about, and then maybe just along with that, if you looked at China versus Vietnam versus India, I call it the V-chips, Vietnam, China, India, Indonesia, the Philippines. How do you look at that? And if you just kind of stack ranked it in terms of where the future is going to go and where the opportunities are.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. We've been in China for, again, many, many years. The first business that we got involved with in China was actually Prometric, which, as you mentioned, is a testing business. And I can remember, for us, opening China back in 93, 94. And when you sort of think about, and if you had sort of ranked China and said, is there going to be a great opportunity? Well, you had a full-on communist government. And I can tell you, I won't take a lot of our time on it, but when they were just opening, and at the time, what capitalism meant was you could sell your excess production of vegetables at a market. You could open a restaurant within your house and have two seats. And they started to allow for, quote, capitalism to occur. And as we were negotiating to set up Prometric in China, the government in the middle of it changed the law to say no foreign company can work on testing in the country. It has to go to the government. So guess what? They became our partner. So over the years, we've navigated China from a time when literally the government mandated you have to be in business with us as the government to today, which is fairly open as a society relative to those times. And I would say there are cyclical moments. I think we're obviously at a point where the exact predictability will be different, but we don't see at this stage, actually, in fact, the demand characteristics in China, the willingness to sort of invest in education couldn't be stronger in general terms. You clearly have to navigate the specific political construct. But just to give you sort of an interesting data point, for all of the relative, reasons to be skeptical at this moment, that we could go through a long list, and you think about things like Chinese students coming to the United States with all of the friction that you have, our summer enrollments for a company that we're involved with called Shorelight were up north of 20% from China. Wow. And every reason in the world could exist to say there should be skepticism that people are going to show up, that COVID's rampant here, that the flights are, we engaged people online, so you had to have modality. But at the end of the day, the point is, I think there is an inherent demand for what we do here to be transported around the world.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So I'm going to combine a couple of concepts. One is coronavirus, how the coronavirus effectively has accelerated the future to the present. And how do you think about the future as it relates to businesses that you're focused on, what some of the ones you already are involved with need to do, combined with the biggest changes you see taking place in the educational industry, and let's segment it, K-12, higher ed, corporate learning.
Okay, well, that you can go on. I think that's like everything together, and we'll figure out the future.
Well, I'm looking at the clock, and I want to make sure I've got a bunch of things.
Yeah. So, I'd say is maybe to hit a few highlights on things. I think we're at a point in our economy in general where government has greater impact today on what's going on than certainly that I can recall during the time that I've been working. And we run a moment where we are at a reset point, either for societal reasons, economic, structural reasons. So when we look going forward, not to punt on it, but to some degree, when we see things, there are macro issues that drive characteristics, but there are also things that are going to change as a function of government policy, because we do have a moment where things are changing, whether it's the government choosing winners and losers from a financial perspective through the Fed or Treasury, or whether it's on policy. When we look at sort of the needs of our society right now, and it's been most pronounced obviously right now with protests, which have brought forth issues that we've confronted for generations but haven't solved, we could very well be looking at a time when you will see corresponding changes at government policy and priorities to be able to both create an impetus to change, but also to change the drivers of where you want to make investments. So we look at that and say, we're sort of eager to both participate in the dialogue on what should change, and on the other side, where it's going. There's some headwinds and tailwinds. So to be specific, I'll try to be brief on it. We're going to wait to see, for instance, in K-12, under normal circumstances, one would assume, for instance, there will be a pullback of investment in K-12 for curriculum and other things because of budgets. Well, it'll also depend where the next fiscal stimulus comes out and what happens with the government. But right now, I think most districts are in the process of reevaluating things on that side. We obviously have gone from full employment to massive unemployment. So we've reset the clock back to 2010 to some degree. And so we have to rethink about the purpose that we have in each part of the chain. We're no longer in the business of purely recruiting whatever talent is available and trying to retain, but the reality is we have to equip today students and participants in our workforce with the skills of the future, not to make it optionally better, but to simply participate in a great way. So I think in every case, we're at a juncture where we've got to rethink each part of that equation. There are clearly things for the next 18 months where we'll see changes in supply and demand and whatever that are COVID related. But post that, I think it's going to be an extended period of digestion of a new economy and how we have to participate within that realm.
So Chris, you have a very unique perspective and a lot going on, and you're a strategist, you're an entrepreneur. We named you Secretary of Education. what would your priorities be? How would you, there's education's opportunities, the great equalizer, there's workforce issues, there's all these things. What would your priorities be if
we were? So maybe, so when I look at education, we've done some things really well. We've increased, for instance, graduation rate at high schools dramatically. But we've done that not necessarily with improving all the outcomes for the kids or aligning high school to college. We have a college system that, through the virtue of massive loan programs, have made it more accessible, but they haven't, at the end of the day, really changed. They've certainly have improved the opportunity for many people, but we've left behind large numbers. So today, and we haven't changed the underlying rules of the game in a way that's allowed innovation. So I'd focus on a few priorities. One is I would look at, in the higher ed system, really revising how we think about accreditation, because those are effectively the ground rules for how institutions behave. Align funding and accreditation toward outcomes rather than through inputs. And today, much of our system is defined by what you put in, how much you invest, as opposed to what you get out. So we have to sort of release the sort of capacity to change in the system, measure the outcomes, and change, I think, both the rules as well as the funding systems to align against that. I would actually increase Pell. I think Pell is one of those areas that is a material impact and an opportunity, and one that's an equalizer. It's of limited scale today, and it works on income, and it could be expanded to employment status. So that, for instance, we've got 20 million people out of work right now. One of the fastest ways to get people back into the retraining would be to make Pell eligible from an employment status standpoint instead of your income last year, and expand that program so that more people have access to essentially a voucherized form of education on things. And I would take a really hard look at the alignment of high school to really both work as well as to college, because right now we have a system that is guided by a set of standards that are individually interesting, but collectively not fulsome in terms of really addressing the needs of a well-educated workforce. So, I mean, there's sort of a perpetual things that one could do, but there are a lot of areas of alignment and investment to make the system really, at the end of the day, measured by how well are students served. That has to be the ultimate measure on things.
I've got a couple pages of questions left, but I just only have time for two questions. So first question, Sintanas, and you talk about sort of the separation of sort of your activity and Doug's activity. I know Doug's the CEO of that business, but real quickly, talk about what Sintanas is doing, how that plays in kind of the future of learning and the partnership with Arizona State University.
Yeah, so first we have it's an early company, and so to that degree, there's still much to be defined, and Doug will be a better spokesman than I, but nonetheless, I know the company, and I think where we see the opportunity is that many things that we see from an affiliation between a top-tier and innovative institution like ASU and international universities around the world, coupled with really expertise that's been built over time through the team and our knowledge of running, as you mentioned, at Laureate, 300 campuses and a million students in over 30 countries. If you combine all of those capabilities and say, how can you really bring first-rate new practices around building and managing institutions around the world between academic expertise coming from ASU coupled with kind of the operating expertise that we gained in building Laureate, that combination of things in partnering with international universities sort of is the centerpiece of what Sintanas is about.
So last question, a lot of exciting things going on, a lot of exciting things that you guys are involved in. If you were to focus on one thing that has you most excited about the future and where you think could have the greatest impact, what would that be? You get one bullet, I apologize.
Yeah, let me ask you. You do mean as a business opportunity or a sort of a policy opportunity on things?
Either. Where do you think can have the greatest impact? Is there a company or an area, or is there just a policy that you think could have the greatest impact in terms of giving everybody an equal opportunity to participate in the future through access to quality education?
Yeah, well, I think the policy one's a longer one, but I think there are a bunch of things on the policy level that really equal the opportunity set. I won't go through them, but I do think we really have to think about the restructuring of the alignment of incentives within our entire funding system. So that, and that's the biggest opportunity, because it's going to take time to change the system. On the on sort of the business side of things, there's, I would say there is a an alignment between K-12 higher education and eliminating sort of the break that takes place between those two, and restructures sort of this idea that says, right now, as you can, as we sort of think about, we have an island called K-12, we have an island called higher ed, we have this weird process of applications, we don't have an alignment between the two of them, and what we really need to do is to take the barriers down, and we think there are business opportunities that sort of take the barriers down in the system and restructure sort of the product. If you think about the product as a four-year credentialing experience and high school as a K-12 experience, and you really think of the outcomes, which have to do with education and being credentialed to work, we think that re-slicing and dicing, starting in high school, ending someplace within that K-16, K-20 plus range, is a, are there ways to restructure things so that you sort of break those boundaries? And we think that's, there's some really interesting areas that one can kind of recraft opportunities. And I'm sorry, I know it'll be run over, but if it's just, this is not something we're doing, but just as an example, find the brightest high school students, train them instead of having gone to college, provide really a combined work and academic experience that lets them earn a credential like a college degree while, for instance, they're working as a software engineer. And you can get the best and brightest pulled out of the system, actually credentialed, making money, no debt, and you can restructure the way these systems work. So we see a lot of those types of opportunities.
It sounds like we have the foundation for the Helen Sarek Scholarship Fund, but but this was absolutely terrific. Thank you so
much
for being with us. Everybody, stay safe, stay sane, and we'll look forward to visiting again soon. Thank you.